This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Jennifer Storm, the Vice President of the AOPA Foundation. In the news, the Cirrus SF-50 Vision Jet fleet is grounded due to an AOA indicator issue. Some CFM International LEAP-1A and LEAP-1B engines are experiencing a fuel nozzle coking problem. A New York Times report questions Boeing 787 Dreamliner production quality. The N9M flying wing has crashed, killing the pilot. There seems to be a correlation between ADS-B and a lower accident rate. And power lines save a Cessna 172, although we don't recommend you try this yourself. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 550 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hey, hello, Max. I got here back just in time. I was off soloing a 16-year-old student. I got to tell you, when he got done, he had a grin that went from ear to ear, and I swear he was at least 2 feet taller.
Ah, amazing.
Very, very exciting.
That is. It's such a meaningful thing for someone that's so young to accomplish that. And I think it's going to affect the rest of his life.
You know, that's one of the last things I told him was everybody remembers their first solo for the rest of their life. And I kind of think it kind of sunk in. His mom was there too. So they were both very happy.
Cool. I hope she's very proud.
Totally.
All right. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, military aviation expert, and he blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hey, everyone. Just so you know, I do know the difference between Jimmy Doolittle and a B-25 Mitchell, just so you know. Also, I also know that, according to Twitter, I don't know this, but James Stewart did fly bombers, specifically B-24s in World War II, and B-47s and B-52s. And B-58. So yes, I know he was a bomber pilot. But other than that, it's been a great week. So that takes care of all of my errors for the screw-ups for the week.
Okay. Every one of us is allowed at least one or two. Well, our guest this episode is Jennifer Storm. She's vice president of the AOPA Foundation. Now, Jennifer oversees all aspects of the foundation, including donor stewardship, major and planned gifts, annual giving, corporate grants, and operations. And as vice president of AOPA Foundation, Jennifer's focused on funding programs that grow the pilot population, improve safety, and make flying more accessible and affordable. Jennifer joined AOPA in 2004 after flight instructing at the University of North Dakota. She developed education programs for the Air Safety Institute and later led the production team. She then went on to serve as director of the AOPA Airport Support Network. That's a national network of 2,000 volunteers. They help AOPA promote, protect, and defend community airports. Jennifer then led AOPA's public relations efforts and the Flight Training Initiative, which was the precursor to the You Can Fly program that we all know. In addition to her roles at AOPA, Jennifer served as Chief Operating Officer of Assessment Compliance Group and as Director of U.S. Network Engagement and Performance for United Way Worldwide. Jennifer, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you all so very much for having me. We really appreciate the opportunity to share what's new.
Now, Jennifer and I saw each other for the first time at Sun and Fun just a couple of weeks ago. We had a great long conversation and learned a lot about what Jennifer's doing these days. And we wanted to get her on the show kind of as soon as possible. So we're happy that we were able to arrange that as quickly as this. Max Trescott, you also saw Jennifer, didn't you, at Sun and Fun?
This is the third time Jennifer and I have talked since January. So yes, we've been crossing paths a lot this year.
All right, great. So why don't we get started with some of the aviation news from the past week? Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
All set.
Well, it seems a theme has emerged in our news stories lately. Lapses of quality in the aviation industry. For obvious reasons, we all want the industry to take its role of keeping us safe seriously, but we've seen examples lately or claims that are raising concerns and maybe shaking public confidence. So why don't we start with Rob Mark's article in Flying Magazine. Our young listener, Ariel, pointed this to us saying, would love to hear your opinion on this, especially Max West. So this is from Flying Magazine. FAA grounds all Cirrus Vision jets over angle of attack issues. Now, the FAA has issued an emergency airworthiness directive. It grounds the Cirrus SF-50 Vision fleet due to an issue with the angle of attack indicators that has produced an uncommanded pitch down in three incidents. Max T, this sounds kind of eerily familiar.
Yeah, it's certainly not the kind of thing you want to have happen. Let me make mention of a couple noteworthy things here. First, Rob didn't get much sleep the night he worked on that article because about 10 o'clock his time, I sent him a text and said, hey, have you seen this? And he said, no. So, when I woke up the next morning, this is what was at Flying Magazine. So I apologize to him for sending it to him too late. Also, the photograph on the top of that article is November 1 Whiskey Alpha, which is the first customer delivery aircraft. So I recognize that. It was back at the factory one of the times I was there. So that's kind of fun to see. So the company has, and by the way, I should say, I really don't know much more about all of this other than what I've read publicly, though I've been tracking the incident for, probably a little over a week now. The company reports that in the very end of last year, I think it was November or December, they had an incident, and then they had two other incidents within the last month or so, and they appeared to be similar. And the key thing that they've uncovered is that the angle of attack indicator, which is supplied to them by a third-party company, who, by the way, is not the same supplier to Boeing. Apparently, there were manufacturing defects in that AOA sensor. If we look at the emergency AD that the FAA came out with, it gives a lot of detail about exactly what the issue was. And they mentioned specifically that there were two set screws that secure the potentiometer shaft to the AOA vane shaft that may have been improperly torqued, and that in some cases there was no application of Loctite to secure the two set screws. So just to kind of back up here, you can think of a potentiometer as kind of like the volume control that you would see in a classic radio or a classic TV. And when you are turning the knob of that volume control, you're varying the resistance, and that information is then sent back to control your volume. Kind of the same thing with the AOA shaft, with the AOA indicator. As it moves up and down, it's twisting a potentiometer. And you can imagine that the connection between the vane, which is hanging outside the aircraft, and the shaft of that potentiometer has to be good. There can't be any slippage. Otherwise, you're going to get inaccurate readings. And that appears to be exactly what's happened here. There's been slippage between that vane, which is out there flying in the wind, and the potentiometer, which is used to generate a specific resistance, which is then measured to determine what angle the shaft is at. So I think the good news here is that both Cirrus and the FAA responded very quickly. And while the fleet is probably going to be grounded for, a couple of weeks, that means roughly 120 jets around the world aren't going anywhere until they've got new angle of attack indicators installed. I think it really speaks well for all involved that they dealt with this issue very quickly. And I should also mention that there's a very easy override procedure, which was published very early on, which is on the side stick that the pilot used to control this jet. There is a yellow button down near the base a little bit, which is kind of a master disconnect override. And holding that is going to, totally disconnect any uncommanded, pitch things that might either with stick shaker movement or things like that. So there have been good communication, good procedures to override any particular failures. And now everything is going to get fixed, but it's going to take at least a few weeks to get enough sensors out in the field and get all these aircraft test flown and then back up in the air.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you about the time and if there are enough of the newer sensors in the pipeline to support the fleet.
Yeah, and I think the answer is no, there aren't enough right now, because if there were, they would all be shipped out today, and I think there's a small number which are due to start shipping at the end of this week, I believe I've heard. And then there's going to be, I think, a bit of a rotating pool. So as people send in their old sensors, I think, though I'm not 100% sure, I think they're going to rework those and then send them out. And that's why there's going to be a little bit of a delay to get 120 of these things available and shipped to all these jets, which are located around the world.
All right. Our next story is from Simple Flying. This is airlines asked to check 737 MAX and A320neo engines after failure risk found. What they're seeing is higher than expected coking on the fuel nozzles on the CFM International LEAP 1A and LEAP 1B engines. Now, you can normally expect a certain amount of carbon buildup on the fuel nozzles, but apparently not at the rate that they are seeing. That kind of buildup can lead to uneven temperatures and hot spots, and then you can get premature wear of hot section components. And in fact, we actually saw this on a Southwest 737 MAX that was flying to Victorville for storage. Now, in that flight, the pilots declared an emergency after losing the right engine. The 737 landed safely, but engine maker CFMI found that coking, it had occurred, and it resulted in a turbine blade failure. Which, of course, that ends the operation of that engine right there. When that happens, we call that metal in the tailpipe, because that's usually what you find. But again, this is the LEAP 1A and the LEAP 1B. The LEAP 1A is used on the Airbus A320 family, along with the Pratt geared turbofan. And the LEAP 1B is used on the Boeing 737. Now, there's no mention of it, but there is a LEAP 1C. Do you guys know what the C stands for? Any guesses?
No,
it's for the COMAC C919, the Chinese airliner in roughly the same class. So that's how CFM International designates their engines. So this is another problem. This affects the 737. That engine, the LEAP 1B, is sole source on the 737 MAX aircraft, so that affects all of them. And, of course, the Airbus A320 family as well. What they're doing now is increased inspections, borescope inspections. So that's a pretty easy thing to do. You don't have to take the engine apart or anything. You just insert the borescope inside the engine and you take a look and see if there's a coking issue or not. And I guess they're only finding it on a limited number of engines. It is another problem that's not contributing to confidence in some of this new hardware.
But the only saving grace about this is Boeing can point it to somebody else.
Yes.
This is not an airframer issue. This is an engine issue. So you can sort of go, well, it's not just me. It's also Airbus. So you can't blame us this time.
Now, there is another issue going on, as reported by the New York Times, that does land squarely in Boeing's lap. The New York Times published an article, "Claims of Shoddy Production Draw Scrutiny to a Second Boeing Jet." Now, the New York Times reported an investigation of the 787 Dreamliner had revealed what they called, quote, shoddy production and weak oversight that have threatened to compromise safety. And they found, quote, a culture that often valued production speed over quality Facing long manufacturing delays, Boeing pushed its workforce to quickly turn out Dreamliners, at times ignoring issues raised by employees. This is not very helpful to Boeing at this point.
And I was kind of intrigued that there's a similarity to a story that we ran probably a month or two ago, which talked about the stop in production of one of their military aircraft because of residual debris inside the aircraft when they're being delivered. And we're hearing the same thing apparently has happened with the 787. I know at the time I mentioned that the huge amount of hiring that's happened with Boeing over the past year. And again, I just wonder if perhaps there have been so many new people brought in that it's a little tough to keep the company culture and the processes and procedures going smoothly as you're ramping up your workforce.
It is kind of frightening that we're talking now multiple factories in multiple states and multiple programs. I mean, this is a cultural failure. You've got the 737 MAX on the technology side. You got the KC-46 where it's a production issue and that's being produced in Seattle. And now we've got the 787 line in South Carolina with the same kind of production issues. Boeing is going to need to do some sort of stand down, or there's a real cultural issue there in that whole work organization.
Yeah, it can't be good for business. I know I've read of at least one sale to China, which went to Airbus, and it's not clear whether Boeing had a good shot at that. But certainly this is going to be one of those things that could tip buyers one way or the other, or if nothing else, force them to get some concessions out of Boeing if they do go ahead with their orders from Boeing.
Yeah, it really does have the feel of a cultural issue, like David points out. And these things can be difficult. I think it's a combination. Well, I don't know, but I can speculate that it's a combination of factors due to this huge increase in the orders and the building of production rates. And it affects not only the airframers, but also the component suppliers as well, the engine OEMs and other aerostructure and component suppliers. Everybody is just ramping up to these almost unprecedented volumes. And that's not an easy thing to do. And it's not easy to do and maintain the level of quality that you need. So I don't know if that's, what we're seeing here or something else, but some of the stories, and these come from a variety of sources for the New York Times investigation, from present and past employees, from whistleblowers, from documents that they've looked at. But, they've found FOD, as David, mentioned, chewing gum holding together part of a door's trim. One thing really concerning is some damaged parts that ended up missing. Some of the employees are wondering, did those get installed on production aircraft? So these are serious issues.
Yeah, and there's another one that talks about discovery of a cluster of metal slivers hanging over wiring that commands the flight controls. And as they point out, if sharp metal pieces were to penetrate the wires, that could be catastrophic. So yeah, that's really worrisome.
Yeah, yeah.
And like what you just both discussed, we're talking about a broad, it's not just like one area of assembly, it's multiple areas and I'm really surprised that we haven't heard more stories. And I have a feeling now that the floodgates are open, we're going to hear a lot, and it's going to be damaging to Boeing big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I started my career in a factory, and it's kind of interesting to see as you get toward the end of the month, there's always tremendous pressure to get things out the door by the end of the month, simply because that's how revenue is recognized when the shipments have occurred. And so just makes one wonder, are there the same kind of pressures here to quickly get it out the door so you can mark it as being shipped, so you can make your revenue number? And when that happens, sometimes corners get cut.
And it's like the old saying, you never buy a car that was built on a Monday or a Friday.
Yeah. I don't know. Jennifer or Max, can you recall any sort of similar sorts of issues in the past with general aviation aircraft. Nothing comes to my mind that's sort of equivalent to this or that might provide some lessons.
Yeah, the only glitch that kind of comes to mind is when Cessna purchased Columbia and then moved production to Mexico. And there were at least one incident of wing delamination that occurred. And after a lot of research, they discovered, oh, the humidity is a little higher in Mexico than it is in Bend, Oregon. And that apparently was contributing to the wings, which are made of composite, not forming up as correctly as they should.
Hmm. All right. Another story, David, you found this. This is something that just occurred. This is some bad news, actually.
Yeah. As we record this, this is Monday, April the 22nd. This afternoon, outside of Chino, California, Planes of Fame had a catastrophic failure with their N9MB. It's a total loss, including the pilot, which is the more important. But you're talking at the N9M, if you don't know it, is Jack Northrop's second flying wing. They made four of them. It was the prototype that led to the B-35, the B-49, and eventually the B-2. It's the proof of concept. It's probably, in my opinion, the prettiest of all of the flying wings, with its yellow and blue, and just it's just gorgeous. And unfortunately, it had a failure today and crashed, leaving the N1M, which is Jack Northrop's first original flying wing, which is still is located at the Udvar-Hazy Center in the Smithsonian. So the original, and that one's called the Jeep, but the they had had a loss of failure in an in-flight fire in 2010 with the N9M, and Planes of Fame rebuilt it again. I remember growing up reading Air Progress and watching the restoration of it, and when they finally got it to fly again, and they were flying it routinely at air shows. It's a very sad and tragic day, more importantly, for the loss of the pilot. But for us historical people, you know, from a standpoint of rare aircraft and flying them and restoring them to flight condition, this is one of those times where I wonder if it's sometimes really worth it. But having seen photographs and videos of that aircraft flying, it should have been restored to flight worthiness, but it's unfortunately we lost it.
Yeah, I think that's the classic issue. Do you fly these lovely old airplanes, or do you just leave them in a museum so you don't end up losing them eventually? And it's a tough question. Now, we had President of Planes and Fame Museum, Steve Hinton, on an episode 386 back in early 2016. And I remember we asked him about the flying characteristics of this aircraft. And I may not be remembering exactly correctly, but I seem to recall him saying that there was a tendency for it to kind of fall off one wing when you were in a turn. And so that it was a little bit more difficult to fly than typical aircraft.
Mm. Yeah, I corroborate, because I'm the one who asked him the question, what's it like to fly it? There was very few people qualified to fly it. And you're talking about an aircraft that, you know, is all wing, and you're controlling your bank and pitch by elevator speed brakes for all intents and purposes on the wings and the pitches of the propellers. Flying wings are a unique aircraft, and Jack Northrop was sure that that was the future of flight. But you know, it's a real loss for the warboard community. It's a loss for Planes of Fame, and it's a loss of life, which we never want to hear. So,
yeah, and I did see this plane when I visited the museum. They used to keep it inside the museum behind the ropes, and then on certain days they would take it out to fly it. It's a remarkably small, but as you said, David, absolutely beautiful aircraft.
Hmm. Do we know, was this performing at an air show or something, or were they just flying this for other reasons? Do we know?
One of Planes of Fame's big air shows is coming up, so I'm sure they were taking it out and you know, getting some hours on it just to get ready for the upcoming air shows. So they flew it on a regular basis, so it wasn't like it was a rarity for it to go up. It's just in this case, something happened. Mm. And we'll eventually find out what.
Yeah. Thoughts with the family. All right. Let's see. This is an item from AOPA. Study shows accidents less likely with ADS-B in. Max Trescott, what's the story here?
Yeah, I ran into this a few days ago, and I thought that was rather intriguing. It's the first time I think I have ever heard that particular claim, and that's pretty good to know. I think if you go back a few years, a lot of pilots were opposed to having to spend money on ADS-B out or ADS-B in. So I think it's pretty gratifying to find out that apparently, according to the study, there are fewer crashes with the aircraft that have this system. So it probably makes it all worthwhile for people to invest in the money to get this kind of equipment.
And is this because of greater awareness of the situation around the aircraft?
Yeah, I would say almost certainly. I have been flying in traffic-equipped aircraft almost 100% of the time for the last 10, 12 years, and it's just remarkable how you can start avoiding aircraft even before you can visually acquire them. So often when I see an aircraft, 5-6 miles away, I'm starting to change altitude or change heading, even though I wouldn't have seen the aircraft at best until it was perhaps 2 miles away. So I suspect that's why we're having fewer close calls.
Hmm. Jennifer, are you able to find the time to fly these days?
Absolutely, as much as possible. Obviously, we have big goals to meet for this year, so that comes first. But flying is as close of a second as it could possibly be.
And are you flying generally ADS-B equipped aircraft? Are you finding pretty solid implementation of that so far as we start this year?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate. I get to fly a range of aircraft, and part of that is working at AOPA with a lot of colleagues who are pilots and aircraft owners. And so I get in quite a range of avionics. But what I've found is that the ADS-B inside, which is more of the optional work, it is so helpful for situational awareness. And thinking back to my days flight instructing, we were first learning to fly, or even far back before then into historical aviation. It's really amazing what we have now compared to what folks had a long time ago.
Yeah, it's quite a bit different. Probably a lot different than when you started flying, Max.
Oh, no question. When I flew, started taking lessons in the 70s, we essentially had two VOR receivers and sometimes a transponder, but, rarely that. So, yeah, it's amazing how much things have changed over the last years. But if you think about it, probably the biggest changes in our lives over the last several decades have been in the electronics area, and so that's reflected in airplanes as well.
Mm, sure. Yeah. All right. Another item, last item, and we kind of talked about this in the post show last time. I think. Isn't this the same one? A crashing small plane was snagged by power lines? That's right. We talked
yes.
about this a little bit after the show.
This had just happened last week as we were putting together our episode. And it's one of those just remarkable situations where you go, wow, these people are incredibly lucky. And essentially what happened is that a Cessna 172 was flying from Niagara Falls down to Long Island at night. And they had very poor weather when they arrived. I believe the visibility was somewhere around a quarter of a mile. Of course, most typical instrument approaches would be only as good as a half mile, which meant that they were flying at airports with weather where the odds of getting in were slim to zero. They did four approaches at Republic Airport before they diverted to Kennedy, because that was the point where they finally told ATC that they were running out of gas. And they did about one turn of the hold, and then they did run out of gas, crashed in a neighborhood, and you would expect that it would be a completely fatal crash. And yet they managed to snag some power pole wires, and miraculously this aircraft just stopped about a foot or two before it hit the ground. So it couldn't have been any more perfect, so that these three people could essentially just, hop a foot or two down to the ground. Their only injury among the three of them was a broken finger. And I would say that they should probably play the lottery, because this is This is a most unusual kind of occurrence. I can only remember two other incidents where planes have been snagged by wires. One was a Cessna 152 many years ago up in the Seattle area, and that was just a day VFR landing, but that pilot was left hanging upside down for hours until they could figure out how to get him down from the aircraft. Another one was a Cirrus that was flying at night in Texas, and he flew a particularly long downwind because he was following another aircraft. And as he flew the long downwind, he got a little bit too low when he turned final, and he clipped power lines. And his wife actually was the one who pulled the parachute after they hit the wires. Now, normally that would be too low to survive. However, they then hit a second set of wires, and the parachute snagged in the second set of wires, and they too ended up hanging a foot or two off the ground. So, yeah, these kinds of miracles occasionally happen, but I wouldn't want to count on them when I'm out there flying.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Is a strategy when all else is lost, aiming for the wires is probably not what you want to do.
No, that's pretty low. That's kind of like the Hail Mary.
Yeah, I actually have a friend who was flying and had an in-flight fire and planned to make an off-airport landing. And as he was approaching a road, the power lines blended in because it was, you know, black color of the power lines against the black color of the road. And so he didn't even see them. And unfortunately, it flipped when they hit the power lines. Tough to anticipate how that will actually all end up. But yeah, it caused a very serious accident because of that. So it's fortunate he survived it.
And I've often thought that roads make really lousy landing strips. I remember bringing a 206 back from the factory in Kansas with the new owner. And we had been flying for probably 20 minutes. And I just kind of said, hey, if you know, the engine quit now, where would you go? And we were surrounded by fields as far as the eye could see. And he said, oh, that road right down there. And it was a little two-lane road. And of course, every road goes to something that mankind has built, and people always want electricity at those places. And so, of course, there were wires right along that road as well, too. And I think, yeah. You know, our instincts are probably often not correct when we think about roads, especially smaller ones.
Again, we're speaking with Jennifer Storm. She's vice president of the AOPA Foundation. Jennifer, again, welcome to the show. You know, when you start to look at AOPA, what you find is that it's not just one sort of, uniform organization. I mean, there are lots of different focus areas or components or segments, AOPA Foundation being one of them. How do you guys refer to the different pieces of AOPA?
That's a great question, Max. It's a question I get often. So AOPA is a membership association, and their work is funded by membership dues. And most people are familiar with the incredible advocacy work of our government affairs team. We also have our publications like AOPA Pilot, and Flight Training Magazine, and of course the website, and then outreach and events where we get to meet members in person and interact with them in ways that we simply can't do from Frederick, Maryland without getting out to see them with our regional events. And then of course the Pilot Information Center that you can call or email for any technical questions, and the member services team that really does support the membership quite a bit. Whereas the AOPA Foundation, we are a nonprofit organization. So we are a true 501c3, which is what makes contributions tax deductible. We support anything that helps build a stronger, safer pilot community. And really the two really important ways that we're doing that right now is through the AOPA You Can Fly program that's getting and keeping more pilots flying, as well as the AOPA Air Safety Institute that's helping pilots fly more safely.
Jennifer, tell us a little bit about the sort of the mission of the AOPA Foundation.
So the AOPA Foundation is really focused on building a stronger, safer pilot community. So when you think about AOPA as a membership organization, they are looking at building a larger group of engaged and active, not just pilots and aircraft owners, but also aviation enthusiasts and people who see the value of GA. When the membership dues come in, they're focused on funding things like our advocacy work, our publications and outreach and events, our Pilot Information Center, and other member services. Whereas that dues revenue cannot possibly cover the work that we do from the AOPA Foundation side with funding the You Can Fly program to get more pilots flying and to get the Air Safety Institute's work done that helps pilots fly more safely.
When was the foundation created? Has it been around for a long time?
Yeah, so there was the Air Safety Foundation that most people are familiar with from years ago. It started out in 1950, and they were really focused on proactively helping pilots fly more safely and really as a way to help protect our freedom to fly. And, you know, of course, if we're not flying safely, that can certainly limit our advocacy efforts and really does affect people's interest in general aviation or even learning to fly themselves. Or their family members' perceptions of, you know, the safety of aviation. Been around for a very long time. And then over the years, we realized that there were other challenges that AOPA needed to help face. And as I mentioned earlier, with dues not being able to cover all of that work, the generous donors that have been funding the Air Safety Foundation for years expressed an interest in being able to support some of those efforts to grow the pilot population, for example. And so over time, we were able to create the AOPA Foundation to cover things beyond just the safety work.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So I know my dues have been going up a little bit, but they're still awfully reasonable. And I guess what I'm hearing is that one way that the organization can achieve all the things that it wants to achieve, but keep the membership dues at a reasonable level is to create this entity, this foundation that can tap into other kinds of financial resources to accomplish all these programs. Is that the way to look at it?
Yes, definitely. Our generous donors to the foundation, they really are making the work happen. And without them, it would be very difficult to pull all of this off.
So let's talk just a little bit about some of the foundation programs. Our AOPA listeners will probably be familiar with most of these, but others may not. So maybe just kind of talk a little bit about the different programs that the foundation is engaged in.
Sure. So when I mentioned earlier, building that stronger, safer pilot community, the stronger aspect relates to growing the pilot population, getting and keeping more pilots flying. And that engaged pilot group is really critical for advocacy efforts. There's also that idea of, you know, what might be in it for us, the larger constituency for advocacy, but also the larger group we are from a product development standpoint. So businesses will be more successful, more likely to invest in product development for us, and hopefully pricing will be more reasonable as a result. So under the You Can Fly program, there's four main initiatives. The high school initiative helps inspire students to consider aviation careers. And even if they don't go the career route, having that positive interaction with general aviation as part of that curriculum is really helpful for us. Then from there, we have a flight training initiative that is working to reduce the student pilot dropout rate by improving the flight training experience. And so we support students and flight instructors and flight schools to help make that happen. The third initiative is flying clubs. One of the things that we learned from research back in 2010 about the optimal flight training experience is that a sense of community can really help with addressing some of the factors that, time and cost issues that people thought were really the main reasons. A sense of community can really be something that helps people stay engaged. And flying clubs also address the affordability factor of continuing to fly and staying engaged. And so we looked at supporting flying clubs, and it's been really successful for us so far, not just in helping new clubs get started, but also supporting existing clubs. And then fourth and finally is the Rusty Pilots program. So we knew that one of the great ways that we could really affect the number of pilots flying actively is to help people who had already put the time and effort into getting certificated and help them get back into flying if somehow they had lapsed. So if life had gotten in the way of their flying, most people that you talk to, if that's the case, they still consider themselves a pilot. They still think they're going to get back into flying someday soon. And our Rusty Pilots program will help make that easier on them.
Each of those programs on its own sounds like a significant effort. You must have a director or someone that is responsible for each of those programs and then reports to you, or are you managing the, you know, the whole thing directly yourself?
So we have an executive director of the You Can Fly program, and her name is Elizabeth Tennyson. And then she has folks that manage each of those initiatives under her. So the foundation side, we're really raising the resources to help fund that work. But because our donors are funding that work, as the foundation, we, of course, want to be engaged and involved because we want to report back to them on the successes and, of course, give the feedback of our donors to those programs. And it's really neat how it evolves. It's not just a funding relationship. It's also, you know, donors getting excited about the work that we're doing and encouraging people that they know, whether it's a local high school to use our curriculum or one of the flying clubs that they know to use our resources, or, you know, having a friend of theirs that's lapsed and they're flying and they're no longer active to go to one of our Rusty Pilot seminars.
I've always been kind of intrigued with the curriculum, the high school curriculum that is being developed. And I guess that, is that, do I recall correctly, that's just sort of rolled out recently?
Yeah, we've been working really hard on it. So right now we have 9th and 10th grade curriculum out and being used across the country in more than 100 classrooms. We're working on the 11th grade curriculum now, and we'll start working on the 12th grade curriculum next year. The idea being that when we first roll out each year of the curriculum, it'll be in a field test cycle for that school year with a smaller group of schools that have really signed up to provide more feedback and be more engaged in that field test cycle so that we are refining the curriculum before releasing it out to more schools the following school year.
And what kind of schools participate in this? I mean, do they come to you? Do you go to them? How does the relationship get developed?
So far, we haven't really had to advertise. We've had so many schools coming to us. And again, because we're rolling this out in a way that is really focused on quality over quantity, it's been a terrific experience so far working with these schools that they already have that level of interest there. As far as the types of schools, it really varies. We've got private schools, public schools, charter schools, and they are in, you know, rural areas, urban areas. It's really across the board. And we're very excited that for the 2019 and 2020 school year, we already have more than 250 schools who have submitted the application and are working through the process of using the curriculum in their classrooms for next school year.
Hmm. I think this is big. I think this is really, really big. Max T, it makes me think of the 16-year-old you were just flying with today.
I don't think there's actually ever been a more exciting time to be involved in aviation. I just think there are tremendous opportunities throughout aviation for people who, to get jobs if they're interested in it. And we just have so much interesting new technology that's being developed. If I think back to the 80s and the 90s, boy, things kind of moved on a glacial time scale. But it's pretty exciting times now. So I can see why folks would like to become involved.
Yeah, that was kind of the one aspect of retiring that was least appealing to me because of the rate of change and all the different things that are going on. Like you say, the different technologies that are coming on. It's, you know, to step back from that is kind of hard because, you know, being in the fray is pretty exciting these days for sure. But Jennifer, you've mentioned donors a couple of times. Who are these people? Are they individuals? Are they organizations or corporations? Who are these donors?
So our donors, who are incredibly generous to our programs, it really is a mix. We've got mostly individuals, and I think a lot of that has to do with it's folks like us who feel like flying has been a huge part of their lives and, you know, a big part of their success in many ways, that really want to give back and make sure that that opportunity exists for others. And then we also have foundations who they have interest in STEM education. And so they want to fund our high school program because they're seeing the results that we're getting and the quality of the content that we're providing to teachers and the type of experiences these students are having. And then, of course, we have corporations. So that's more along the lines of companies who are looking at it and saying there's been a declining pilot population for many years. And if that's their customer base, there's definitely an interest in funding the work that we're already doing and having, you know, good success with, and rather than trying to create something of their own to try and address the problem.
Hmm. Now, I know I made a contribution to the foundation in 2017, and I wasn't sure what year it was for sure until I... I realized that I had a really easy way to find out, which is to look at the lid of my laptop and then take a look at the AOPA Foundation sticker that's on there, which says 2017. So I think that there was, I don't know, there was some kind of an appeal, some kind of an imperative that caused me to contribute myself. But these kinds of imperatives, I mean, they continue today, don't they?
They sure do. So the most exciting one that we're offering at this time is a matching grant opportunity. So the Ray Foundation, who's been very generous to the You Can Fly program over the years, challenged us to raise $2 million to support the You Can Fly program by August 31st of this year. And if we're able to do that, they're going to offer us a matching grant dollar for dollar for each of those donations. So as a contributor, if you give $100 to the You Can Fly program, they're going to match it, and that'll become $200 for the You Can Fly program. So if we raise $2 million from our generous donors, we'll have $4 million to support the program for the coming years.
Wow, that's a pretty significant multiplier. And it sounds like something that everybody can help contribute towards, right? Not just rely on large donors. It sounds like donations from individuals as well are very important.
Oh, absolutely. We have so many individuals who've given so generously to the You Can Fly program. When we look at the You Can Fly Challenge results from last year in 2018, we had more than 3,800 supporters. So those are folks that gave any dollar amount whatsoever. And you know, whether it's $10 or $10,000, whatever it might be, it does all add up, and every contribution truly does count.
And of course, AOPA has a website, aopa.org, but the foundation also has an easy to remember website. I think it's aopafoundation.org, isn't it?
It sure is. And if anyone is interested in contributing to the You Can Fly Challenge for this year to get that match and have double the impact for the contribution, it's aopafoundation.org/challenge. And it's important to use that /challenge because it takes you to a form where it restricts your gift to the You Can Fly program to make sure that it will be matched by the Ray Foundation.
Okay, I'm in.
Terrific. Thanks for your support.
Sure. And I'll give my standard statement with, you know, AOPA, of course, is the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, but you don't have to be an aircraft owner, because I'm not, and you don't have to be an aircraft pilot, because I'm not, but you can still join to support the cause, as it were. But this is a big year for AOPA. This is the 80th anniversary year.
That's true. We're very excited.
And I guess the big celebration event is at the upcoming regional in Frederick, Maryland. That's coming up really quick, though.
Yep, May 10th and 11th. And we're really excited for our 80th anniversary to host our members and other aviation enthusiasts here in Frederick.
I'm going to be off at another event, unfortunately. I'm committed myself, otherwise I would take the trip down to Frederick for that, because I think it's going to be a really, really exciting weekend. It is. It's a weekend event, right?
It sure is. Yeah, it's Friday and Saturday, and there's free seminars, and then there's also workshops that are more in-depth where there's a fee for all of the workshops, and then you can choose which ones that you'd like to go to. And then Friday evening, there's a really fun flight line cookout planned. There'll be lots of activities, and we're actually going to have a flyover from the D-Day squadron and a night drone air show. It really is exciting.
Yeah. We missed the drone air show, the night drone air show at Sun and Fun,
you know,
didn't we?
I might have to just drive down Friday night.
We'd love to have you.
I'll cover it for that other show, but and for all of those who our listeners to our UAV Digest show, you don't have to be a pilot. You don't have to be a owner of an airplane. But if you own a drone and you pilot one, you can be a member of AOPA. And I recommend that highly.
That's right. They have a membership category for drone pilots, which was, I think, a highly intelligent thing to do. We had Kat on the UAV Digest kind of a while ago. But how is she doing, Jennifer? Do you know?
She's doing really well. She is really a tremendous asset for the organization because you really want someone leading that area who walks the walk and really can represent that group within the organization when we're thinking about how can we best serve them. And especially when we're looking at it from the manned pilot side is how can we make sure that we're safely integrating drones into the airspace?
It's been interesting to watch how pilots of manned aircraft have viewed drones. And I think that there was certainly a lot of initial, well, I was going to say skepticism, but maybe fear is even a more accurate term. But as awareness has grown, I think that even though we still have problems, especially around airports, but I think as awareness has grown, the pilot population has come to more of an understanding of drones and what they're all about. And I think as we talked about with Kat, drone flying can be a gateway to manned aviation. And certainly we see it going the other direction as well. Max T, are you still flying drones occasionally?
I still own a number of drones, but most of my flying is with our RC planes. I'll tell you why. They're harder to fly, so that makes it more challenging.
Yeah, the drones are so automated these days. The control software is just it makes it kind of magical.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Are you going to be at the regional in Frederick, Maryland?
I will be. I'm looking forward to being there, and I'll be giving a presentation, so it should be fun to get back.
Can you say what your presentation is going to be?
Of course. It's my 3-hour advanced IFR seminar. I think it's going to be on Saturday.
Wow. 3 hours?
Okay. I have another reason to go to Frederick.
Yeah.
I know you're interested in IFR, David, but I would start with the basic course before you get to the advanced one.
Well, I know, but it's 2 hours away. I have no excuse.
I'm teasing,
not to go
of course.
There.
It's going to be fun to see you.
Are you going to, if David comes, will you give him a break or is he going to have to sit there for 3 hours?
Actually, I think I'm
going to. I don't know what he just dropped out, so I don't know what you two conspired about, but okay.
No, I asked about a break in a 3-hour program.
Before and afters.
This is for hardy pilots.
Hardy pilots, okay. Jennifer, let's talk about flying. You've been a pilot for quite some time, I understand.
Yeah, I sure have. I have wanted to be a pilot since I was a little girl, and I finally had the opportunity, even though I started training in suburban Detroit where I'm from, I couldn't really afford to get my private pilot certificate until I went to college and could use student loans to help fund that flying. So I went to the University of North Dakota, which I think is a terrific program. I'm so glad that I went to school there. I think it's an incredible value. And I'm on the alumni advisory board there now because I'm still a big believer in the work that they continue to do as the industry changes.
Hmm. Did you have other aviators in your family that kind of sparked your interest, or was there something else?
No, I didn't. And in fact, my parents were quite skeptical of the idea. My mother thinks flying is dangerous. And so that might be part of the aspect of safety in my career is the flight training and flight safety side may have come from, wanting to make sure that people felt comfortable in airplanes and that they realize it's an incredible experience for the pilots and as well as a real economic driver for communities. But yeah, I definitely, it's all I ever wanted to do. I didn't have any other grand ideas. So I'm really thankful that I discovered flight training and flight safety as career options because I realized about halfway through my undergraduate degree that going to the airlines probably wasn't going to be the best fit for me. Back at that time, the compensation wasn't what it is today. It's really a terrific opportunity for those coming out of their training now to be able to make a living wage, really, as a pilot now. And while I didn't have that opportunity, I'm really thankful for those these days that do.
Jennifer, I noticed that you've been a flight instructor, I guess, in the past. Are you doing that now, or was that something from your earlier days?
Yeah, gosh, I loved flight instructing. I wish I had time to be doing it now. But again, that focus on the foundation's goals won't allow me to be instructing at the moment.
What is it about flight instructing that was so appealing to you?
I think when you love flying yourself and you get to share that with someone else, I mean, when people talk about teaching in general and they talk about seeing their students' light bulb moments, it takes it to a whole nother level when you're sitting in an airplane with them. And the idea of helping someone go from, you know, being a pedestrian to a pilot is pretty incredible. And I just had some terrific students, some, you know, who are flying in the industry and some who are in other parts of the aviation industry that, I mean, they definitely helped make it such a positive experience. But I think just helping anyone see something that maybe they thought would be complex or would be difficult and showing them that they can break it down and they can accomplish it is it's not just about the knowledge. It's about the confidence that you gain in becoming a pilot. And, you know, when you think about doing something difficult, you can sit there and tell yourself, well, gosh, I'm a pilot. I can probably figure this out. I learned how to fly an airplane. I can probably do this. And when you're an instructor, you say, I can teach people to fly airplanes. I can probably teach them to do some of these things. So it's definitely, it was certainly a confidence builder for me as I was growing up. And it was a really incredible opportunity. So you want others to have that same opportunity.
Sure, sure. And like you say, it's got to be so gratifying to introduce flying to someone else and to develop them into a pilot. That's got to be a great feeling of accomplishment.
Yeah, definitely. As Max mentioned, soloing a 16-year-old student today and his mom being there. And there is nothing like your first solo, at the airport and then your solo cross country. And those experiences, are certainly memorable, but it's definitely gratifying to help someone have that experience and be a part of it as a flight instructor. And while I couldn't make a living doing it at that time in the industry, and I was fortunate to have the opportunity to work in other aspects of flight training and flight safety, thanks to AOPA. It really is something that it's a dream that I have really is retirement, that when I get to that point, I would love to have an airplane and provide flight instruction free of charge. Instead of offering scholarship dollars, I'll provide scholarship flight training.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So working for AOPA, I mean, it's kind of like living the dream, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, when I first started working here, I had to pinch myself. When you pull up to the building, you think, gosh, I work here. These people hired me. And I was really fortunate straight out of graduate school to be hired by Bruce Landsberg to work at the Air Safety Foundation to write continuing education courses for pilots, the online courses, the in-person seminars, the print publications. I mean, not only was it really neat to be at AOPA working with these people who are just so smart and so experienced and so dedicated, but you also felt like you were really helping by creating that continuing education that was free for pilots. And they didn't even have to be AOPA members. It was just something that, you know, the Air Safety Foundation at the time, now the Air Safety Institute, was charged with that mission. And we were definitely proud to be doing that work.
Yeah, that's wonderful stuff. Hey, have you been flying anything, particularly noteworthy or interesting lately?
Yes, I am so fortunate to be back here at AOPA because I have a number of colleagues and friends who own airplanes. And AOPA is based right on Frederick Municipal Airport. So we can actually walk right outside across the street to the ramp that AOPA has on the airport. And we have a number of aircraft that we use for flight training and, you know, GA travel as part of walking the walk of being a General Aviation Association. And so it's really an easy way to stay current. Although a lot of us do get focused on our mission with our jobs, we have some big goals with the AOPA Foundation this year. And so I always have to stay focused on that, but we try to get out and fly as much as we can. I've been really fortunate lately that I had a chance to fly an AirCam for the first time. Yeah, what an incredible airplane. It is. It gets up and down so quickly. I was telling someone else about the flight, and they said, yeah, I heard it's like an elevator. And I thought, what a great metaphor for that airplane.
Yeah, I saw the AirCam at Sun and Fun, and I kind of did a double take. I mean, I was aware of AirCams, but this was the first time I'd seen one. The one they had on display was on floats. So, boy, that makes an airplane look a lot larger and imposing than others. But maybe describe the AirCam for people listening who may not be familiar with it.
Sure. It's an experimental aircraft. It's amateur built, and it has two engines. They're Rotax engines that are mounted on the top, and they're exposed, and it's an open cockpit. You can get a full enclosure, but the one I was in was an open cockpit, and to me, that was part of the real AirCam experience. And we were on floats. And so we landed on a lake, one lake twice and another lake once. And it was just, the performance is really incredible. And I was flying with a very good friend. So it was an all around terrific experience.
Wow, that's fantastic. I, you know, as I saw that, the air cam, the thought kind of ran through my head that this wind in your face kind of flying, open cockpit flying is, I don't know, it just feels really pure. And I mean, because I've never even been in a biplane, in an open cockpit biplane before. So, but just the idea seems kind of appealing. So how did it handle relative to other airplanes? This is a high wing. It's got those two motors, two engines, as you said. I like two engines. Being an engine guy, I like two engines.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. The redundancy is helpful. So it's a very responsive aircraft. And I mean, for those who haven't seen it or flown it, it's a stick. It's not a yoke. And so that's somewhat of an adjustment for folks who haven't done that before. But the ability to take off in less than 100 feet and land in less than 500, I mean, that's as advertised, and I felt like it was less than that. It really is an incredible performance, and it's just so fun to fly. And I think a large part of it is that open cockpit, but the performance is terrific.
And it's a real fly low and slow kind of a design, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's how they advertise it, is low and slow, but it doesn't feel that slow when you're flying in it because you have the relative motion of the things around you at that height. And so you've got the trees just off your shoulder. And so I think it seems like you're going faster than you are. But just the ability to land on a lake and see the wildlife around you, it's a totally different experience. Mm.
And this was at Sun and Fun, right?
It was.
Mm-hmm. Did they have a seaplane base? Where was this from with the lake? I didn't know that there was water. Well, I guess Florida, that part of... See, I don't know Florida very well, but I imagine that part of Florida's got lots of water, lots of lakes.
Yeah, there are quite a few lakes around there. We went out of Bartow, so it's not that far from Sun and Fun, where this particular airplane is hangared. But most people will think about, you know, going to see an air cam at Sebring, Florida, where they have the factory and they can do a demo and a tour. So it's not that far away.
Maybe next year when I go to Sun and Fun, I'll have an opportunity to, I don't know, I'm not a pilot, but while I'm intrigued by the open cockpit idea, I'm also a little bit afraid.
There's nothing to be afraid of, but fear is normal. And with any kind of flying, if you feel a little bit of fear, that's all right. It's just how we manage it.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, it's like... I don't know, respecting dangerous power tools, things like that. When you become complacent and it just seems routine, that's when it becomes dangerous. So I imagine it's the same with flying.
I think so. And being conscious of the risks is a good thing. So I don't think we want to be reckless or act as if there's no fear whatsoever. There is something to that self-preservation that exists in the human brain.
Yeah. Are there any airplanes out there that you haven't flown that you would just love to?
A Learjet. Just the speed.
Have you flown a jet before?
I have flown a jet, right seat, but I've not flown a Learjet, and that would be incredibly fun.
I think so, too. Yeah. Just to sort of wrap things up and make sure that everyone is clear on everything, I just wanted to sort of review the organization and the foundation and all, and make sure that I have it right, make sure everybody understands. And I think one of the key aspects of AOPA that we talked about was that AOPA itself is a membership organization that's supported by dues, and the AOPA Foundation is not supported by dues, but it's supported by funds from donors.
So that's correct. AOPA is funded by membership dues, and that supports all the advocacy work. It's done so well by our terrific government affairs team, the publications and the outreach and the events, as well as the Pilot Information Center and membership services. Whereas the AOPA Foundation is funded by generous donations from our supporters. And that work that we can fund because of those donations is the AOPA Air Safety Institute and the You Can Fly program. And the way to think about that work is that dues can't possibly fund all of that. It had to be done with the support of our generous donors. And it really is ambitious work. I mean, with the You Can Fly program, we are really trying to get and keep more pilots flying. And that comes down to not just the life-changing experience that it is for those individuals, but the more pilots that we have actively engaged, the stronger we are as a constituency. And that's really helpful for our advocacy efforts. And on the safety side with the Air Safety Institute, if we're not flying safely, we know how it gets covered in the media. We know how that affects people's perceptions of general aviation. And so it's really important that the safer that we are, again, the more effective that we can be for advocacy purposes and protecting our freedom to fly.
Can you give us some examples of the kinds of things that the Air Safety Institute does in order to achieve those objectives?
So the AOPA Air Safety Institute, they do research, education, and outreach to see if we can get closer to having zero accidents. And we definitely have a low accident rate, and it's been a lot of efforts that have led to that. But I think that we're always striving for zero, and it's really important. The loss of life alone is a tragedy, but again, that the effect that it has on the perception of aviation in general is a challenge. And so they do a lot of work on the education side, and that's where I started with AOPA, as we discussed, on helping pilots think about flying a little bit differently. So maybe by seeing something that the Air Safety Institute produced, they're going to think about a flight differently. They're going to ask themselves a question in a way that they hadn't before. And we have had people come up to us at events and say, I made a different choice about a flight because of a program that I saw with the Air Safety Institute.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's good.
Yeah, it really is. It's. I mean, talk about rewarding. They're really always looking to improve. Richard McSpadden, who leads the Air Safety Institute as its executive director, has really done a terrific job in thinking about what is it that the viewers want and what's most helpful to pilots. So they've gradually shifted to shorter format content. They have a lot of videos and podcasts, and really made a huge difference in activity when they started posting things to YouTube. And, you know, it's just there's so much viewership out there on YouTube that just by going to where the viewers are, it makes a big difference in how much we're seeing those resources being utilized.
And then as for the You Can Fly initiatives, that's Katie Pribble that heads that up?
So the You Can Fly program does have the four initiatives, the high school initiative, flight training, flying clubs, and Rusty Pilots. And that really got kicked off when Mark Baker came to AOPA and recognized that if we didn't start addressing the declining pilot population in a more holistic way, it was really going to be tough to turn the numbers around. And it was such dramatic numbers. I mean, the drop from the 80s to the 2000s and the number of certificates issued was pretty stark. And so Mark got our board of trustees on board. He found some really incredible angel investors to help us kick off the work because we had started the flight training initiative years ago. And that was something I had worked on. And when we launched that, everybody was excited and we thought this is the right thing to do, but we didn't really have the funding to make it happen. And so with Mark Baker having the leadership and the dedication to commit to it, and then Katie Pribble, the Senior Vice President of Aviation Programs and Operations, really ran with that charter and made sure that the You Can Fly initiatives got off the ground and started getting some really great results. And while Katie has transitioned to a different role with AOPA, Elizabeth Tennyson is now the executive director of the You Can Fly program. Katie is still working with us, and we're really grateful to still have her on the team. But Elizabeth Tennyson is really looking at how do we scale this work now? And that's part of where the AOPA Foundation comes in, because we fund all of the operations of the You Can Fly program. And so when we think about the success of the programs that we have today, we have more interest developing. So for the high school initiative, for example, we have more and more schools contacting us wanting to implement the curriculum at their school, but we do have requirements for them to be a part of professional development so that we can make sure that the program is being delivered effectively. And so we need to be providing support for that work. And so the scaling of that is really where those resources come in. And again, if not for our generous donors, the program wouldn't exist in the first place. But to see that we're scaling into more and more schools, I mean, coming up to 250 schools across the country for the 2019-2020 school year, we really do depend on those resources to make it happen.
Hmm. And it does make sense to me that you'd want to vet the high schools to a certain degree. I mean, you don't want to just accept, you know, anybody that may not be fully dedicated to it or may have other aspects that put the success of that program at that high school at risk. Have the high schools so far stood up to the task at hand? Have they been doing their part to make it successful?
You're absolutely right. We do have to keep a focus on quality, and that is first and foremost. Quantity is nice, but quality has to come first with this work, because it's something that as you implement in more and more schools, it gets harder to control something like that. But we don't want to make it too hard on the schools. They have enough challenges as it is, if you can think about your local school system.
Yeah, sure.
They're hungry for this type of resource with the curriculum that's so turnkey, because they do want experiences for students that, you know, that science, technology, engineering, and math or STEM. You know, it's such a helpful program to implement if they're trying to meet that need. And now that there are more career opportunities in aviation, not just for pilots, but many areas of aviation, you know, they're seeing us as a pretty life-changing opportunity for some of these students who, you know, otherwise may not have that chance to really change their economic circumstances with a career like this.
Sure.
And so when it comes to the high schools, we're really only asking them to make the commitment to do professional development, and that's something that we provide, as well as to submit data to us. So we want to know, you know, as the school year goes on, how many students do you have signed up, how many completed. So really the only thing that we are really keen on is give us the data, because that's what we need to be able to track and report, not just to our supporters, but when we're looking at the success of the program long term.
Mm. And the instructors, the teachers delivering the instruction to the students, are these folks that have some kind of aviation background to help them, or is the curriculum itself designed in a way that that's not necessary?
So we have designed the curriculum that the instructor does not have to have aviation experience, because it's not common that school teacher would have it.
Sure.
And so we wanted it to be able to scale quite a bit. And so that was definitely a requirement. We do have some instructors who are pilots, and maybe they don't have as much classroom teaching experience, or some classroom teachers who don't have flight training experience. They're not pilots. And so we adapt based on whatever it is that they need. And that's really one of the key things of the professional development that we provide, is making sure that they feel comfortable with whatever experience they may be lacking.
Hmm. This is just also amazing to me that AOPA can create and deliver these kinds of programs, these kinds of initiatives of this quality level. It's just amazing. You know, everybody at AOPA should be feeling really good about the things that they're accomplishing on behalf of a lot of other people.
Yeah, we are incredibly proud to be doing this work. And really what it took is a commitment. And when you think about some of the things that we're doing and the expense and effort that it does take to make them happen, it probably wouldn't make sense for a for-profit organization to pursue this. It had to be something that, you know, an organization like AOPA said, this is important and we're going to find a way to make it happen. And again, we're just so fortunate to have generous supporters who will fund the work because they believe it's making a difference.
Okay. And as we've said, the AOPA Foundation You Can Fly Challenge is on now. There's a $2 million goal by, when is the deadline? August 31st?
That's correct. There is a matching grant opportunity, and it's $2 million at stake. So for donations we raise to support the You Can Fly program by August 31st, they will be matched dollar for dollar up to $2 million for a potential total of $4 million for the You Can Fly program, which goes a long way in supporting this work and scaling it out across the country. So that is available at aopafoundation.org/challenge. And it's important to use that donation form rather than the AOPA Foundation standard form, because that will restrict your donation to the You Can Fly program, which makes it eligible for that matching grant from the Ray Foundation.
Very good. Jennifer Storm, Vice President, AOPA Foundation. Are you having fun, Jennifer? I think you are.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that was one of the main takeaways from the conversation that we had at Sun and Fun, is that this is really incredible work to be a part of it, making sure that it can happen from a resources side, and then being involved with the folks that are actually executing these programs, it's really incredible.
Very good. All right. Thanks again, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
What's up with the geeks? Let's see, who's got something interesting going on? Max Trescott, you've always got something interesting going on.
Oh boy, I've got a number of seminars coming up. Let's see, I have a brand new seminar called So You Want to Fly or Buy a Cirrus? And I came up with that title because I remember years ago the government used to have a booklet called So You Want to Buy a Wild Burro or something like that. I think the Bureau of Land Management had a publication, some title like that. But anyway, I gave this seminar for the first time at Sun and Fun a couple of weeks ago. And I will be giving it live here in the Silicon Valley area on May 8th and May 15th. So anybody in Northern California who wants to come, it's going to be in Palo Alto on May the 8th at 7:30 and on May the 15th at 7:30 in San Carlos, both of those at the West Valley Flying Club. And if you can't make it, but it is something of interest to you, just send me an email and we'll figure out how to get some information into your hands. And then I should also mention that episode 106 of the Aviation News Talk podcast is available. And that is another one of our safety moments with Rob Mark. So we've done these before and probably continue them in the future. And this particular one, we focus on VFR into IMC accidents, of which there have been a number recently. So we talked about the accidents, how to avoid getting into them, and what to do if you find yourself in the clouds accidentally. So all that on the Aviation News Talk podcast. Hmm.
Rob keeps showing up behind the mic, doesn't he?
He loves it. But he loves it.
He does love it. We had a great time with him. It's Sun and Fun behind the mic when we had our Airplane Geeks live episode. That was a lot of fun.
I'm always surprised that he's not an amateur radio operator because he's a real big hand.
Yeah. David, anything to tell us about?
No, just happy to be podcasting twice a week and talking about drones and talking about airplanes. And you know, Max and I next week get years older, so we've been doing this now for a long time.
That's right.
And while I could also say this, next week will be the anniversary. It'll be 4 years now since my major surgery, and I will never forget and always appreciate all of the love, affection, good thoughts, and emails and everything I got when I was going through that from all of our listeners. So thank you for that. And it's been 4 years, so that's a good thing.
Wow. That was a tough time. And boy, it doesn't seem like it was 4 years ago. That's amazing.
Trust me, it doesn't.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. What have I got going on? I've got a trip to Seattle coming up. That's in early May. And I have hopes to tour the Viking Air facility. I've been talking about that for a long time. And also touring around some of the other aviation companies in the Seattle area. Of course, I'll meet up with Isaac, and we'll have some fun together doing some of those things, and then I'll do some of those on my own. So I'm really looking forward to that. That's the Viking Air trip at the Seattle area. And then we have the D-Day squadron coming up, and just got a release from the D-Day squadron today. They announced the kickoff for the North Atlantic crossing. And so it says the D-Day squadron is part of the Tunisian Foundation, announced the starting point for the squadron's journey to Europe over the original Blue Spruce route to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the invasion of Normandy. Now, the aircraft will depart from Waterbury, Oxford Airport in Oxford, Connecticut, that's down the road from me, on May 19th, 2019. But the planes will be there a full week. Before that, they've got some activities to kick off the event, including they're hopeful a special squadron flyover of the Statue of Liberty. That would be fairly dramatic. So the C-47s arrive in Oxford on May 12th, 2019. Then the aircraft and crews will spend that week practicing says critical skills such as formation flying, survival skills training, oceanic procedures, and European Union operations training. And then again on Saturday the 14th, the entire D-Day squadron is going to have that flying formation from Oxford up the Hudson River in New York, over Manhattan Island, and around the Statue of Liberty. So if you're in the New York City area on the 14th of May, you're going to want to watch for that. And then, again, the squadron will depart on May 19th, make some stops along the way, arrive at Duxford Airfield, and they'll join up with their European counterparts, Dax over Normandy, and they're going to participate in several events on June 2nd through 5th. The combined fleet of historic aircraft will cross the English Channel on June 5th, fly over Normandy, France, and participate in multiple events over in France from June 5th through 9th. So lots of activity on this side of the Atlantic, the other side of the Atlantic. I know there's some interest in kind of getting together while the D-Day squadron is over at Waterbury-Duxford Airport in Connecticut. So touch base if you haven't already. I know some folks in the Slack team have been talking about it. Otherwise, send me an email at maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. If you'd like to sort of try to get coordinated with something for that. I'm looking forward to that, David. A bunch of C-47s all leaving the airport. I'm gonna be right there.
Okay, rub it in.
But I'm sensing a missed opportunity here. Have you checked with them to see if they have an official podcast associated with the North Atlantic Crossing? Because I'm thinking you probably ought to be on board to record this event.
Well, I have applied for media credentials, and there is the opportunity for some media flights, not across the Atlantic, but around Connecticut. So I just might be able to do that. We'll see. Hopefully, we'll be able to do that.
Well, be a stowaway if you need to.
If you've never been in a C-47, it's an amazing flight.
Yeah, yeah. So have you been in one, David?
Yes. Actually, I was in an R4D, actually. Mid-Atlantic Air Museum has a Navy R4D. And back in the early 90s, when I was tooling around with the museum, I flew from Reading, Pennsylvania down to Philadelphia, down to Andrews Air Force Base for the air show weekend. Their R4D, it was a transport. An executive transport. So it had an airliner interior. So it was kind of like flying on a C-47 and getting a DC-3 experience also. So no sides. So I haven't been in an official cargo carrying parachute jumping aircraft, but it's on the bucket list. I'm sure I'll get one eventually.
All right. Very good. Now, just a shout out to Equator Aircraft. You may recall back in episode 473, we spoke with the CEO of Equator Aircraft, Thomas Broderskift, and they're developing the P2 Excursion. It's a, they call it a high-performance hybrid amphibious aircraft. Well, they've had their first flight. They call it the first flight out of ground effect. And in fact, they had, I think, two flights just recently, the 29th of March and a second flight on the 30th of March. And for these flights, they're all electric. And again, this is an amphibious aircraft. Max, it's kind of a nice design. I mean, it looks, it just looks sleek and like it would just take to water like a duck.
And it does have kind of a classic design for amphibians. You know, it's got a prop which is mounted high, in this case mounted on the tail, and the bottom of the aircraft serves as a hull when it's on the water. So yeah, it does looks like a fun plane.
And this is a two-seater at this point, the P2. There's a a clue from the designation, I guess. They do plan to hopefully develop larger aircraft in the future, maybe even a commuter-sized plane. So good luck to Equator Aircraft with that, and congratulations on the first flight.
I won't make the standard extension cord joke.
Okay. All right, some listener mail. Let's see. Well, we heard from Mike and Stefan, the Strasser brothers. These are the Chicken Wings Aviation Comics guys that we talked about, we had on the show, actually, and also generously provided some autographed books, some Chicken Wings books that we gave away in a drawing. Well, you may recall that when we talked with them and asked about what might be in the future, they mentioned the possibility of animation, and they have, in fact, just finished their first animated cartoon, and it's a blast. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, and yeah, you can also find it on YouTube, but take a look at this. It's a nice little story, and you know, boy, the animation is, it's all smooth. It's, you know, it's like a professional kind of, you know, animated cartoon. Congratulations to the guys on that.
Yeah, I love good animation. It's just kind of, I guess it would be fun to figure out how to actually do this. I have no idea how they created it.
Yeah, I don't know. Is it the way that they used to do cartoons like this, you know, frame by frame, and, you know, you flip through them quickly and it looks like it's all smooth. I don't know. Another interesting thing, or a fun thing about it, is unlike the, you know, the static comics that we're used to from Chicken Wings, there are voices with these characters, and it's kind of fun to listen to the voices that they've used.
And of course, the best part, it includes a tanker in it.
Yes, there is a tanker. David, I don't know if you've seen this cartoon. It is about a tanker, so you got to check it out.
Yeah, I know. Of course it's about a tanker.
All right. So, yeah, congratulations to the guys. And I think that's it. Do we have anything else?
Avengers is out this weekend, coming up.
That's right. It'll probably be mobbed. Maybe I'll wait a week. All right, then. So we want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We also want to thank our guest, Jennifer Storm, Vice President, AOPA Foundation, and we really appreciate her taking the time. She's very, very busy, as you can imagine, and we encourage you to take a look at the AOPA Foundation, and if you have the means to do so, consider contributing. As always, you can find us on our website at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/550. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. And let's see, who's up first? Max Trescott's up first. Where do we find you online?
Well, you can find me out there soloing students at the Palo Alto Airport, which is always fun. But online, you can find me at aviationnewstalk.com. If you click on contact at the top of the page, you can shoot me an email about anything you'd like. And if you click on listener questions, you can record a question, which I will more than likely answer on the Aviation News Talk podcast, which is available wherever you find podcasts.
Cool. David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
Well, first of all, I got to give my solicitation for being on the Slack listener team. You can get an invitation to join the fun behind closed doors with the secret mystery password that we give you. And that's, you can send us an email to feedback. Oh. You can send us an email to thegeeks@airplaygeeks.com or feedback@theuavdigest.com. Either way, you'll get your invite. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can also, I want to give a shout out to anyone who recently or wants to leave some feedback. And this goes also for Mr. Trescott on whatever podcast device you listen to, either Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, whatever, to leave some feedback so that other people can find us. We always want to grow and improve our listenership and reach out more. So that's News Talk, you know, as well as The Geeks or the PacSets podcast. But leave some feedback so everybody knows we're there. And last but not least, you can hear me talking about drones with Heather and Max on the UAV Digest on Fridays.
And just to maybe to mention, to make it clear, the Slack group that we created it really was set up to serve not only airplane geeks, but also the UAV Digest and also the PaxX podcast. So if you're not familiar with Slack, there are different channels, and you can subscribe to the different channels. So if you're interested in unmanned aviation, you can be part of the UAV Digest channel. And if you're not, then you don't have to. But we have groups or channels in there for events and meetups. Things like Spotting Pictures is a new channel, relatively new channel that we set up. People can post their photos there. We create channels and then let them go as things sort of ebb and flow. I really have found that I spend more time in there than I do in other social media platforms where there's a lot of extraneous noise going on. Besides there, you can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight, as David says, at the UAVDigest.com, with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. Again, my email is maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions where he incorporates aviation sounds into other music at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few...